My name is Brent Brown, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Brent.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you all here to the Toronto for the 70th International Convention. I'd like to take a moment of silence in gratitude for AA recovery for the past 7 years. I get to take a couple of minutes in between speakers to tell you a little bit about myself. It says it. So in between meetings, I can take a minute or two to tell you about myself. But I will tell you, I'm from Austin, Texas. And that's really, really kind of like North San Antonio. So y'all come down there sometime. That many, huh? Okay. On to our celebration of sobriety. And the reason I can laugh about this is celebration. We're not a glum lot, and we are about celebration of sobriety. And I'm sure our speakers are going to bring that to our attention. And this is what this is all about. It's a big giant celebration. And if you're not enjoying yourself, there's something wrong with you. It's not me. I take no blame for that. Okay, well, enough of me. Let's get on with why we really are here. And our first speaker, since they changed this little ground for me, the first speaker would be Cheryl L. from Florida.
I'll keep this short. I promised myself I'd always say that before I speak. I am an alcoholic, and my name is Cheryl. It's wonderful to see all your faces, as different as it is to be in front of a large group. It just shows me it's that many more people who are clean and sober and happy and celebrating. I thought nobody would be here because they'd all be out celebrating. I was nervous. I knew God would be here with me, but I have the very good fortune of looking at my sponsor, Betty Lou, from the west coast of Florida, the Gulf of Florida, my dear friend in the program, Bonnie, and Dr. John, who is one of our old-timers, and I live right near him. So I touch the hand of God through my friends. I am very happy to be alive. I surely didn't think that I'd make it past the 30th birthday. The cake went face down after I drank a bottle of rum and cursed at my parents for being the worst parents in the world. I remember always never having enough, never being satisfied, never understanding life on life's terms, thinking that life would be perfect. And because it wasn't, I had to drink to bury the world and relieve myself from all the torment that I believe I created with the help of my disease, of course. So I don't take blame for it, but I understand the realities of this deadly disease. When I was four, I went down the aisle as a flower girl, and they told me to throw the petals, and I did. I started to throw the petals, but about halfway down, I thought to myself, and I hadn't picked up a drink yet, I thought, I better go back and get some. What if I don't have enough to get to the end of the aisle where the bride and groom are? My mother is going, oh, my God, stop! That's me as an alcoholic. One of the greatest joys of my life is understanding that, for me, life is perfectly imperfect. It has saved my butt and has helped me to let things go, which, again, frees me to smile. And it gives me the chance to be a grown-up. And actually, a lot of my inadequacies was because I didn't feel like a real person. And in many ways, I wasn't. But I also, I have to stop and say, today is my daddy's 84th birthday. And we're very lucky that he and my mother are celebrating it together. And she said particularly he was very lucky that he was alive. And he didn't really understand what she was saying. She said, that's right, because I was going to kill you, and I changed my mind. These people that I condemned for what they did to me and what they didn't do for me are so dear to me in my life, and amazing, I understand the pains that they've gone through. So I had two children. I had two divorces by the time I was 25. I went for help high and low to figure out what was wrong with me. Why? And I managed finally to get into therapy. Oh, it was only $83,000, you know, big deal, but my therapist, whose name is Moses, is this true? He was treating me, I'm drinking. Finally, and at that time of my life, the only person on earth that I could trust was Ira Moses. And he fired me. He said, I don't want your money. I don't want you coming here and wasting my time. You are a drunk. Go to AA, and then I'll consider seeing you again. Imagine he didn't want my money. Where he said, not once, keep going back. And I did, because I was petrified to lose the only friend that I had, even though I had to pay him to be my friend. I never have to do that again. I went, I stayed a couple of times. By the first meeting, the lady who spoke in New Haven, Connecticut, said that she was a princess. I knew I was in the right place. Oh, God. It was really, I identified very deeply at that first meeting. And I still felt, though, that I was more powerful than AA. So I went out for a couple of months more, and I came back in the month of July, 1981. So I'll celebrate, God willing, 24 years this month. Now, I really am a celebrator, because I never could figure out whether I was supposed to celebrate the last day that I drank or the first day that I didn't. So I take both the 11th and the 12th of July as my anniversary dates. That's it. Yeah. Then I got a little puppy. I'm getting ahead of myself. AA, ironically, has given me every single thing, plus, to infinity, and plus again, that I tried to get from the bottle. It's beyond belief that I can live from miracle to miracle. And I, as long as I keep my eyes open and my ears open and accept God's grace, that's the way it's gone for 24 years, very progressively, but that's why I'm here tonight. In 1999, the weekend that Lance Armstrong started his first Tour de France, I was diagnosed with an incurable cancer and was in a deep, dark hole of depression with my darling husband, Bill. I've been married to Bill for about 18 years. So finally I managed to do it right. We were scared. And I had a moment in time where I thought, I cannot do this. I cannot go through any more pain in my life. I couldn't even imagine what would happen. It just sounded deadly. It was my personal September 11th. And then I realized in almost a moment's time, and this is God, and this is God that works, who works through everyone here, I said, how could I split from this world? How could I cop out of this one and leave that kind of legacy to my children, my husband, my grandchildren, my parents, my friends in AA, and God? How can I be that selfish? And that was a turning point. So I reached another turning point in my life. I stood there and I said, I'll do what I have to do, take the hydrogen bomb to knock this thing out, and I did. And so I had a stem cell rescue, and the disease supposedly is inside of me, but I don't give it any reason to dance around. So I laugh a lot. My parents and I have made decisions to tell each other jokes at least once a day, and now I get back to Gracie, my little Maltese. When it was my birthday after the bone marrow transplant, Bill buys me a little beautiful white fluffy dog. And Judy Collins has been her voice in that song. So I named my puppy Gracie, G-R-A-C-E-E. But her full name is Amazing Gracie. And when I take her somewhere with me to go into a store and they say, no, only service dogs, I say, she is a service dog. They say, a Maltese? You mean they gave me a Maltese? That's for my daddy and that's for my brother. May you rest in peace, Dougie. I have been given everything I've wanted in my life, and most of all, I am able to give in a way that I was perfectly incapable of doing. I have, no doubt about it, caused myself post-traumatic stress disorder from my entire life. And I have to be careful with myself. I've been put on notice, first with the alcoholism, the disease that can be arrested. Secondly, with the kind of cancer, another disease that can be arrested. And I have to take care. Easy does it. Think. And I refuse to torture myself in shallow water if I'm going to commit suicide. I did that until I got sober. And so I really take care of myself, and I know that's what God wants me to do. And I know that just as I am an example to you, you are all the same to me. And how many times God has multiplied his blessings, as those of us saw last evening. And on the 50th birthday, when little Lois was there, and she said, look at this, we're in 152 countries in 50 years. Think about where will we be in the next 50 years. And I took that to heart. I was 4 years sober then. I really held it in. And last night, 183 flags. 183 flags. And all those beautiful people laughing, smiling, blowing bubbles. It was absolutely wonderful. So I have given myself to a power far greater than myself. It's a relief. I found what I wanted. I really, honestly, never had a peaceful day drinking. I know others can say differently, but it ruined me from the very, very second. And even when I wasn't drinking, I was PTSDing. So I am free. And I know how to love. And I surely know how to laugh. And we're going to boogie tonight. I love you all, and thank you for allowing me to share my story.
Wow.
Thank you. Well, I'm not going to waste any time in between speakers. They sound too good, so I'm going to move right along. I could embarrass my favorite Al-Anon. Yeah. I've been married almost 45 years to my favorite Al-Anon. She's back there. Believe me, she's qualified. Oh. Moving along, celebrating all this happiness. Carly G came all the way across the big ocean from Northern Ireland. Let's see what he has to share with us.
My name is Carly. I'm a recovering alcoholic. And I've been greetings from AA in Ireland. And thank you for making me and my wife welcome. I've then introduced her. You know, I call her my third wife. She preferred to be called my last wife. But it's it's a privilege to be here to celebrate sobriety, and I want to thank Cheryl for sharing and Brent for introducing me. I'm a member of the 12 and 12 group in a town called Ballymena, which is just 30 miles north, and the co-founder of the group. The group's only 3 months old. And the co-founder, Sean, is my buddy sitting down there. That's Sean sitting there in the yellow shirt. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I got to mention his friend Donald. He's got a bit of resentment if he don't do that. Those two guys went to school together and were recovered together. I met Sean when I was 3 weeks sober. He was 18 months sober. And I celebrate today 11,554 days, one day at a time. Yeah. The sobriety date is... I'll tell you the sobriety date because you may start to try and work it out and then you'll not hear what I have to say. The sobriety date is the 21st of February, 1974. Yeah. And, you know, there's a saying in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you got sober in February, you're the last of the Christmas drunks. And I certainly was the last of the Christmas drunks, because my last drunk started just before Christmas, 1973. And I can remember I managed to break the windscreen of a car with my head at 3 o'clock in the morning. The car stopped and I decided to go on. I was pretty drunk because I had gone out just to have 2 drinks. And I asked them to put 4 shots of Bacardi in a tall glass and 2 bottles of Coke. And I thought, you know, if you just have 2 drinks, that's okay. So that was the first drink. And I remember I got this carry out to bring to my mum's. She was living on this. I was going to my mother's for Christmas, and I had all these booze for all these friends who were coming to visit me, and brandy and vodka, and didn't have any friends by that time. But what my mother did was she hid all the booze except one bottle of sherry, and she made some soup out of the turkey after Christmas, and while she wasn't watching, I poured the whole bottle of sherry into the soup, not realizing that it would cook the alcohol out, but my mother said it was the best soup she ever made. But to share a little of the story of drinking, you know, I'm very fortunate that I came to my first meeting and I haven't had to take a drink from my first meeting, nor a mood changing drug of any kind up until today, one day at a time. And you know, that's it's a daily reprieve contingent on my spiritual condition. And I know why exactly today that I don't drink. I know exactly why today that I'm celebrating sobriety. And there are three things, and I tell you, if there's anybody new in the room, and don't suggest anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, do it. The first weekend I met my friend Donald, we were at a Scottish convention, if Donald remembers, in Ayr, Scotland. I was about 4 months sober, and I found this sentence in AA of Comes of Age, and I spent the weekend shouting it, and it is, action is the magic word. And that's, and the three things I've got to tell you that I know why I have recovered from the disease of alcohol today on a daily basis is, first of all, at the very first meeting I went to, I was introduced to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They didn't suggest to buy it. They told me to buy it. They made me buy it because if they said we give it to you, you'll not read it. Spend your money on it. Buy it. I asked somebody, and I don't know, he's here this weekend. He's a guy I did my first step with. Guy Sammy B, and I remember going to Sammy and say, where do we start in this book? And he said, page one's a good place. But that was it. The second thing I was told in this program was to get sponsors. Now, I heard the word sponsors. I didn't hear the word sponsor. So I went out and I got 4 sponsors. 2 easy ones and 2 hard ones. Now, what I actually did was I asked the hard ones the easy questions and I asked the easy ones the hard questions. But I went to this guy who's one of my sponsors, and Donald and Sean would know them both well, an old guy called John McGann. And John McGann had spent some time in Los Angeles and had met with Chuck C and brought tapes of Chuck C back to Ireland. And I went to John McGann and I had this really big problem, and John yawned when I was talking to him. And I said, John, am I boring you? And he said, you take that damned long to say anything. Now, there is a saying in Alcoholics Anonymous of who comes after a collie. They say, Tuesday. My wife says, how are you going to talk for 20 minutes? I said, I'll talk fast. And I have one of the things I've got to be aware of, I've got to be out of jail before 4:10, so I'll do my best. But in saying that, John yawned, and I said, am I boring you? And he says, you take that down. And I got up, and I left, and I went round the corner to another sponsor who just lived round the corner. And a man to which I love my life, and he sponsored some of the people that's in this room tonight, an old guy called Danny R. from Belfast, and we loved him. And I said to Danny about John, and John, he says, well, you do take a long time to get to the point. He says, you always go round the houses, as my wife knows, when I'm talking about anything. And he says, what was the problem anyway? And I says, I forget. But Danny, that was the second thing. Danny became a sponsor, and I remember I asked Danny, I said, Danny, what do I need to do exactly to get sober? And Danny says, Colin, you need to have a personality change. And I said, how am I going to do that? How am I going to have a personality change? And he says, if you practice the 12 steps of this recovery program, I can guarantee you that you'll have a personality change. Danny didn't tell any lies. I know that this afternoon. I've had a personality change. So the third thing why I'm standing here today is the 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So those are the three things. But I was very fortunate, as I said, when it came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I did a lot of the yes. I got married for the first time in 1966. That marriage broke up in 69. And I ended up living in the streets of London as a hippie in 1969. Now, there's a thing driving my friend Sean mad that I'm always late. We're driving off for a meeting and Sean calls to collect me and I'm not ready. And they're known as the late collie. And I was so late I nearly missed the 60s. So it was 69. You know, and one of the things they say about the 60s was sex, drug, and rock and roll. Well, I didn't see too much sex. A little bit of drugs and a whole lot of rock and roll. So I lived in the streets in London, 69. I got myself back together again. I got a job. What you discovered, I could steal a lot of money every day. And I was the delivery man for a certain kind of soft drink. It wasn't Coca-Cola. It was the yellow one. But I have made me amends, and if there's anybody here from the Pepsi Cola Corporation, it's okay. I have made me amends today to them. But after a couple of years, I used to count up how much you stole every day, and I realized that I'd stole more than bank robbers had. And it was a pretty frightening experience. But I needed to do it to feed my habit of alcoholism. Self-centered and selfish to the core, and that was the person that I was. I was the only person who mattered. Then what happened was I went to a party on, we call it Boxing Nights, on Stephen's Day, 26th of December. And I give Christ the party. I was pretty drunk. I've been drinking Guinness and hot Irish whiskey, and it's a combination to blow the head off you if you drink anything like that. And I give Christ this party, and they ran out of booze at the party, and I just lived, had an apartment a couple of streets away, and I went round there, and I brought my Christmas carry out, which consisted of 24 cans of lager. And I set it on the floor, and it suddenly disappeared, and there was none left for me. And then I took a little thing that might be a couple of people in this room know about. It's a word called resentment. So when I got resentment, I got the resentment started to grow, and I says, I'm going to fix these guys. Now, we call it a petrol bomb, but you'd better know it as a Molotov cocktail, where you take a milk bottle, you fill it full of gasoline, and I'd heard these people talking about it because they were using it for riots in the streets, and I'd heard these guys talking at work how they made it, and I threw it through the window of a party. Thank God I didn't kill anybody, but I ended up, and I was the only non-political bomber on B-Wing in the Crumlin Road prison in Belfast. Now, that's not an accolade that my mother actually planned for me when I was born. But when I was in that prison cell, there was AA meetings going on, and my friend Sean was actually one of the people at that time carrying messages. Sean's been in the prison for 32 years. And I wouldn't go to AA meetings because I said I loved alcohol too much. I love what it does to me. I didn't like the taste of it, but I did love what alcohol did to me. I loved that warm glow that I got on my tummy, and that feeling of being one with the world and being somebody. And I can remember standing in a pub, and I heard these two guys who are salesmen talking, and one says, let me pay for this drink. I had a good day of sales today. And I said, someday I want to do that. And I said, and today I'm actually running my own company. I'm a sales trainer today, training salespeople. And I said, it's a good idea not to drink. But I ended up in jail. A guy shared a cell with me for 3 months. He was in on the drunken driving charge on a DUI. This guy had been through rehab, through a Shaftesbury Square Hospital, Belfast. And he said to me, you know, Colin, there's a good chance you're an alcoholic. And I said, don't be silly. I love booze too much, and I don't drink gin. So he said, well, first of all, Colin, why are you in prison? And I said, because I threw this bomb into the party. And he said, and would you have done it if you were sober? I said, that's a stupid question. Of course I wouldn't. Ah, so alcohol has you in prison. I didn't like that. And the only other thing that guy said, and I can remember it to this, and I say it to every new man when I 12-step him today, I'd say this. He said, it's not the quality nor the quantity of the alcohol. It's what it does to you. And what it's done to you, Collie, it's got you a 2-year sentence in this jail. And that stuck. I came out of jail after serving 16 months, and I discovered that my tolerance for alcohol had gone. I discovered that I couldn't drink anymore. Not bad, I'm out of jail by 4:05. I discovered that my tolerance for alcohol had gone. So I just thought, you're out of practice. You just drink a little more and you'll get used to it. But the practice never came back. A father who suffered from multiple sclerosis died in February the 11th, 1973. They couldn't find me the day my father had died. I was in a late-night drinking club in Belfast, and some of these clubs were pretty hairy. I used to sing the wrong songs in the wrong clubs. And if you know Belfast, that's not the thing to do. But being an alcoholic, I always wanted to take the other point of view. So in doing that. But it came to a point in my life where I could live no longer than I was. I was mentally, physically, and spiritually bankrupt. Physically, I wasn't too well. I was 29 years old. I've skipped over briefly my 3 visits to mental hospitals, where I got a letter from a doctor in 1967, which said that, Colin, you'll need some. This man will need some form of medication for the rest of his life. The only medication I take today is from a diabetes. That's the only medication that I need today. I don't need the kind of medication that he needs. I got electric shock treatment on 2 occasions. They tried to treat me for paranoid schizophrenia, which is not true. It was the disease of alcoholism from which I suffered. And I came to this program because so many people aren't misdiagnosed that it's alcoholism. And thank God for it that I met that guy, who I don't know if he ever got sober or not, that I met in the prison cell. So I got into AA. I've been privileged. I've been around that program 3 times. Because I believe I can just do a little better. I often say that, you know, the 12 steps shouldn't be in a straight line. They should be in a circle. because I have to keep clearing away the wreckage of my past. I've got a power in my life today that I trust implicitly. Implicitly for everything. I've got some buddies here from the internet who are sitting over there, which are, and some people that I've just met from the internet sitting down front here. I run the business completely on trust and a power grid of myself. I have an internet site. People find me and I turn up and do some sales training. And I trust that God does that for me. And my wife knows that I'll say, we need another check, and it arrives in the post next morning. 12 promises. That's what they said. And it's not that I'm rich, but I don't have financial insecurity anymore. Well, sometimes when they pay me late. Better say that because my wife will remind me of that. But I do have a power in my life today. I believe in the 10th step that I've got to take inventory of my life. And the 11th step through prayer and meditation. And not medication, as some people would say. Meditation. And you know, I thought that I would have to study all these Eastern philosophies to find out how to meditate. Today, they say they know the measure of a man, how well you can sit in the room just with your own thoughts. And that's what I believe in meditation. I believe an AA meeting is a meditation. And I remember the words of Chuck C, who said, what you come looking for, you come looking with. And that's what I've discovered in Alcoholics Anonymous. What I come looking for, I came looking with. And you people showed it to me from yourselves. And I have only one thing to say. Thank you for my life.
Thank you, Colin. That gives us good reason to know that Alcoholics Anonymous is alive and well in Ireland. Jeez, that was fantastic. Thank you very much. Our next speaker will be Bruce H. from Tennessee. Let's welcome him. Give him a warm welcome.
I'm Bruce, and I'm an alcoholic. First, I want to thank you for allowing me to be here and share with you. I have a confession to make. First, I want to tell you, I went to the Pioneers meeting before noon today. I'm feeling you were there. It was just wonderful. But I think I added up the total sobriety of the three speakers was about 140 years, I believe. And I must tell you, I've been in the program for about 1 year and a half, and so I feel rather inadequate to tell you. I'll tell you how I got here. I don't know how other people get on this program, but this is what happened to me. I heard about the convention and made my plans in the spring. Meanwhile, I had a daughter graduating from college in New York City. By the way, I'm from Tennessee. I don't sound like I'm from New York, probably, too. So I made my plans to come to the convention, went to New York, and I heard that the headquarters were in New York. And I don't know if any of you have ever been to the headquarters, but it's quite an interesting experience. So I said, okay, I want to go see that. It's out on Riverside Drive. And you go out, and first of all, it's a big building. There's nothing except the address and nothing else. You go in the lobby. There's no directory on the wall. You can't figure out where anything is. It is truly anonymous. You walk up to the information desk and ask, and they say, oh, yes, you need to take the elevator up to the 11th floor. So I did. And I must say, my son, Paul, who I will tell you about a little bit later, is here with me today. And Paul and I went up, and all of a sudden you see a triangle on the wall and quotes by Bill Duggan and everything. You go in and you check in, and they first let you look at the little archives area, and you see old letters and books from Bill Duggan and lots of photographs and things. It's really fascinating. But then they take you on a little tour. So a young lady took us around, and here's the office of this, that, and everything. They're telling you that 80 people work here and everything. And we came to one door that had International Convention on the door. And there was a gentleman in there working, and he stepped out and said, hi, my name's Doug. I said, well, good. He said, are you going to Toronto? I said, well, yes, I just happen to be. He said, you know, I need somebody on a program up there. I promised. I couldn't make this up. So I said, well, tell me about it. He said, all you have to do is introduce the speakers. This is the way it evolved. He said, I've got a program. You just stand up and introduce speakers, and it'll be easy. I said, okay, sounds easy. Went on down the hall. 5 minutes later, he came back and said, you know, the bad news, that's an Italian meeting I was getting into. But I've got another meeting called Celebrating Sobriety, and you'll do great at that one. And I said, well, what do I have to do? He said, well, you just, you know, stand up there and just talk a little bit. And I said, well, how big is it? And he said, oh, there won't be many people there. Don't worry about it. So go ahead. Anyway, he said, do this. He said, think about it, 24 hours. If I don't hear from you by the time you get back to Tennessee, then I'll assume you're on. I said, okay. So I didn't have the heart to tell him no. Then of all things, I get this letter, and this is what they tell you if you all wonder how you get your topic. This is in the letter. Ever mindful of AA's purpose, as we ask all speakers as they weave the selected topic into their talk to focus on their experience, strength, and hope as it relates to their recovery in AA from alcoholism. Now, did that tell me what to say? I don't think it did, except it said tell you about my experience, strength, and hope. Oh, I neglected to tell you that when he asked me if I'd be a speaker, I said, well, I guess so. I've never done that before, even in my home group. So this is my initial time. And I did write a few notes. I hope all you old timers don't mind. I thought I would just tell you not to go too long, and I am watching, and you help remind me if I get too long-winded here. How I wound up not only here today but in AA, it wasn't one of my lifelong goals. I think all of you have that same thought to be in AA. I grew up in a small town, a city in West Tennessee, about 35,000 in those days. My dad was a doctor. My mother was, he was an only child, did not drink. My mother, and there was a little clue here which I didn't catch on to, was from a family of 8 children. Her parents, those grandparents, were absolute alcoholics. And of those 8 children, 4 of them were absolute alcoholics. My mother was what you might call, I've heard it called, emotionally shut down, dry drunk. She never drank, but there was a real kind of emotional detachment. And I found out early on that I could get a lot of attention and what I needed by what I could do to achieve things. So I started achieving at an early age. Unfortunately, my dad died rather suddenly when I was 15 years old. I was left with that. I had an older brother who had already left home, a younger sister, and I kind of became the surrogate dad. And it was never said to me, you need to become a doctor, but there was a certain feeling there that maybe I needed to carry on that. Nevertheless, I didn't drink in high school. I was with the right crowd. I had learned how to excel. I was valedictorian, student body president, did all those things that get that attention and that validation that we need that we're not getting other ways. Made my plans, went to college. I sort of remember the first time I drank, and it wasn't any momentous occasion, but we were double dating, and some guy said, well, you got anything to drink? I said, no, I really haven't ever drunk but a few beers. And he said, well, get some gin. It's a good way to start. And so I think it was a half pint of gin, and I finished it off fairly rapidly and got sick, and the next day felt terrible, and I really wasn't very excited about drinking at that point. So that was my start. Went on through college, got into medical school. I, by the way, along the way decided I did want to become a doctor. In spite of that expectation, I first rebelled and took a lot of economics courses, but I finally said that's what I really want to do, and I did. I went to Vanderbilt in Nashville, wound up marrying the girl I had met in at Rhodes College in Memphis. Didn't drink a lot then. I was pretty serious about what I wanted to do and achieve, and you really didn't have a lot of time to drink if you were serious about it, and so I didn't. I drank some and weekends and parties, but it wasn't a big factor in my life. Left there, went out to Iowa City, did about 4 or 5 years of my training. My specialty is ophthalmology. I do eye disease, cataract surgery, and so did that. Came back and actually settled in my hometown of Tennessee. About that time, my son was born, Paul, who I mentioned is 29 years old now. And I must say, Paul has been in the program 4 and a half years and showed me the way. And even though my drinking wasn't excessive in those days, through the eyes of AA, when I look back now, I see those character defects that were there. And that primarily that old self-centeredness of I'm the one and look out, get out of my way. I had this attitude, I think a lot of what I say I gave at the office, it means that at home, and this came at later, I heard my mother say my dad had this, bless his soul, I never really picked up on it, but he told her one time, you raise the children and I'll bring home the bacon, you sort of run the family. And I think I felt that way, and whether it was getting up to change a diaper or whatever it took, I really didn't want to participate at home. Within a few years, my wife really didn't think that was good, and a lot of other things happened, but she decided she wanted to leave, and she did. So she left and took my three children, age 7, 5, and 4, and I got so depressed that I know something about depression. I actually dropped out of my practice, was hospitalized for a month. And I found out then there's a really strong association, and many of you know this, between alcoholism and depression, and many of you may experience that in your own life. I was not kooky enough to put in the lock-up area, so in the psych hospital, I was on the ward where all the addicts were, drug and alcohol, and there wasn't really an issue with my drinking. They just don't know where else to put me. But I wound up going to a lot of AA meetings in and out, and I got introduced to AA, but I thought, oh, thank goodness, I don't have a problem like that. So I lived alone for about 3 years, and another miracle in my life, my only sweetheart in high school days back in old Jackson had been married and divorced, living in Nashville. She was in a wreck on the interstate, wound up in the hospital, and the long and short of it, we wound up getting married 3 years later. I'm 19 years on that marriage, so that has been another miracle that was given to me. Somewhere along the way, my drinking just got worse. It wasn't one of those I was in the gutter, but it was an insidious thing. I would notice the pressures of the day. I'd want to get home and is it close to 5 so I can get a drink. Saturdays, if I don't start drinking till noon, I guess I don't have a problem type thing. So, but I would be drinking weekends and nights. I was careful to avoid. Most physicians understand you can drink, that's socially acceptable if you don't act drunk or get caught being drunk. Drugs are not really an option because that does things like take your license away, so you know socially we can drink. So I never got a DUI, never got turned in at work and as an impaired physician, but it was obvious my life was getting out of control. About 2 years ago, it got worse and worse, and that fall had a couple of instances. Oh, I'll take it back quickly to what led up to that. For so long, it seemed like it had sort of two lives, and I don't know if this rings the bell to anybody, but you've got the drinking life over here where you're doing your thing in the day, your job and all, and getting by, and then you've got, you're doing your job, no drink, you've got the drinking life at home. I didn't go to bars, go out, socialize, I just drank at home weekends. Finally, those worlds began to overlap, and they began to run together, and you can't separate them. And whether it's you're going to a meeting at night, a church meeting or whatever, and I saw nothing wrong with going to church every morning, every Sunday, and going home and start drinking that afternoon, but you're going to a meeting, you're afraid somebody's going to smell it, you're going to sound funny. The marvel of caller ID, your son or your daughter's call, and you won't pick up the phone because you might sound drunk, and those kinds of things are happening. My other daughter graduated from law school not too long ago, and we were in Atlanta and went out to celebrate her graduation, and I was too drunk to, I got up out of the restaurant, but made a fool of myself. Those little things that begin to happen that, as you know, destroy all the things that are valuable to your relationships. So finally, in summer, then fall of 03, 18 months ago, I had a couple of instances I embarrassed my wife and myself, and we sat down she said, something's got to give. And I turned to my old friend who had treated me when I was depressed. He's a psychiatrist, a wonderful fellow, John, in Memphis, who is recovered about 25 or 30 years. And John, I went to see John. I said, John, I think I've got a problem. Do you think I'm an alcoholic? And he looked at me and said, well, Bruce, I don't know. Only you're going to be able to tell. But I tell you, I think you need to take some time out. Go up to a little treatment place near Nashville of an old friend of mine named Murray Smith, is an addictionologist, an old Vandy grad. And he's an internist, and there are only about 3,000 or 4,000 of these guys called addictionologists. He runs this little center. Go up there and see what happens. And I said, well, do you think I can figure it out in one weekend? He said, well, maybe you better allow a little more time than that. So, thank goodness I went. I got introduced to AA. I wound up staying 2 weeks at least. I got introduced to AA there. It was a very good program, studying the steps. But we would go out to these meetings around Nashville. And I saw something there that I just couldn't explain. These people seemed to have something that I just couldn't get. They seemed to be happy, and they talked about not drinking. I'd been in church all my life. I'm an elder in the church. I've come at it if you're in the South, you're in the Baptist church from the time you're 5 years old, and had done all those things. But I always thought people at church had something that I couldn't figure out what it was. I didn't quite fit in. Went through all the motions, but there was something they had. And I'm convinced there are people that aren't drinkers in church who really do have a spiritual life, and they understand it. But I didn't. So I thought, these people have something, and so I started looking at it a little better. I came back home, plugged in, started going to AA, and I think that the other thing, I saw the honesty there that I had never seen anywhere, people talking about their lives and their problems that I didn't see in church. There's a phrase that comes up in the 24-hour book I hear over and over. How am I doing? Okay, 5 minutes. Three. Okay, I'll hurry up. I'm down to my last card. Okay. There's a phrase that comes up in the 24-hour book, and they use it and say, we are bound by space and time. And that sort of hit me as I read that at some point, that we are bound by space and time. And to me, it meant, as a scientific background, I always had trouble with something I couldn't see or feel or measure, you know, the unseen world. And even though I've been involved in church and all, there was something that was missing. But it took this disease and the steps for me to discover that there is a power available to me that I can't see and feel and touch that is beyond space and time. If I'm just willing to take that first small step. There's a saying or a little story, I don't know if you've heard this, but I've always liked it. A lot of us addicts, alcoholics, there are two doors, and we're in this room, and one of the doors says heaven above it, and the other one says lectures about heaven. And all you have to do is just walk up to the door that says heaven, it opens, and you go in. But I'm over here, and a lot of us in this line wanting to get the lectures first to figure it out before I go in. And that was me. And I've got a whole room full of books on self-help and how to figure it out and analysis. And I love the Shroud of Turin. Do you all know about the Shroud? And this is it. We finally got the proof. You know, and then they proved it was not real. And so I gave up on that. Anyway, I was always trying to figure it out and understand it, and before I took the plunge. The program has really taught me that I can't figure it out, and that's okay. All I have to do is accept the fact that God has it figured out, and then that's not my job. I just need to be willing to accept the power and the love, and that door will open for me. It said that I should weave this topic into my talk, and all I can tell you is that celebrating sobriety to me is about having one life instead of two. It's about the fact my kids can call me 24 hours a day and I'm the same sober person any time, day or night. And it's about the fact that God has figured it out and that I don't have to. And I thank you and I thank AA.
A year and a half. You know, that's what sponsorship's about, obviously. Obviously, he has a sponsor, obviously, he believes in the program, and obviously, he's got something to celebrate. You know, sometimes people say you got to hang around a long time before you can say something. You know, that's amazing, you know, and I think Doug wandering out and wanting them just to chair a meeting and then coming in and saying, well, can't chair a meeting, maybe you should share something that you have to say. And I don't know about these miracles, but I just believe in these miracles. And that's a miracle, and thank you for so much for that, because it restores at a year and a half in this program, I was saying things like, what's a GSR? That was my profound thing. And the answer to that was, you are. And see, I went through that whole process, one position at a time, until I can get up here and tell you I'm a panel 54 delegate. The miracle of that and the celebration of that is I come from Southwest Texas. That's where I'm delegate, in Southwest Texas. And see, they don't look like me in Southwest Texas. but what it is because of the program Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm allowed to be able to get along with all the different factions of Southwest Texas. I get along with this side, and I get along with the urban side, and I get along with the rural side. And see, no, I didn't use any little nicknames in there. Got respect. And you can fill those names in if you want, you know. And you're welcome, like you come to San Antonio, you'll see what I'm talking about. But you know what? Things like that is what makes us able to celebrate that. Celebrate sobriety and the change in our lives. And I'm not going to take your time. You got plenty of time. You got, and I, you know. They told me I can do 5 minutes between each of you. No, I don't take life serious. I take the program serious. And I take things like what I just heard serious. You know, when somebody says, well, I never shared in my home group, but I guess I'll come up to this international convention thing and see what they think of it. See, that makes this a mighty, mighty awesome program. And, and without further ado with that, boy, this is a great program. Without that, any further ado, how about Bob D. from Nevada? And I left some money there.
You're not getting it back. I think I should borrow Bruce's notes. My name's Bob Darrell. I am alcoholic.
Hi, Bob.
It's good to be here. I'm amazed how many people, how many friends I have in this room, from Florida to Alaska, just amazing. I'd like to thank the other speakers and our chairperson. Did a great job. They all did a great job. There's two lies that you'll hear frequently in AA. First one is, I'm going to be brief. And the second one is, I got one more thing to say and then I'll quit. I'm going to try not to break into one of those today. Topics are hard for me. A friend of mine reminded me, coming here, of why I'm here. I'm not here to talk about a topic. I'm here to talk to a person. I don't know who that person is, but I know you're here. And I don't know where you are, and I probably won't even know who you are, but I know you're here. And actually, I think I'm here to talk to two people. Maybe the person that's doesn't know how to celebrate sobriety, because sobriety feels like you're doing time. It's depressing, and you're thinking about taking some pills because you don't know what else to do. I'm here to talk to you because you are me. And I'm also here to talk to the guy who's leaving AA and doesn't even know he's leaving. He's leaving one judgment at a time. I'm here to talk to you because you are me also. And I want you to know, when this celebrating deal, drinking was the greatest celebration I'd ever found for a number of years. I mean, there was something very incredible about drinking in the early days. I mean, when it says in our book, a feeling of conviviality and a feeling that life was good, they're not kidding. It was awesome. I could walk into a bar so locked up inside of me and depressed like a mope, have 4 or 5 drinks, I'd come out and play. I could talk to people. I felt like you looked. And then as the disease started to progress and alcohol started to turn on me, I'll tell you, there was nothing to celebrate in my last couple of years of drinking. I'd entered that bleak, horrible stage of alcoholism where I'm drinking frantically and desperately trying to jumpstart the party, and it won't jumpstart. And I can't get back to the good old days, and I'm dying. And I don't know what's wrong with me. You know, I tried everything there was to try. I tried the medicines and the psychiatry and all that stuff. And in 1978, after being a chronic relapser in Alcoholics Anonymous, trying all the psychiatry and the medicine and church, and I've been everything from Ram Dass to Rum Dum, and the end result is I'm standing, 1978, I'm standing on a bridge with a bottle of Richard's Wild Irish Rose. I've been homeless for almost 3 years, and I was the guy with the potential, and I'm trying to kill myself, trying to get up enough courage to kill myself. And this is not celebration drinking. I mean, there's no party in this. This is awful. I don't even bathe anymore because I don't care. Right? I don't even care. There's no happiness in my life. It's bleak. And I'm trying to kill myself because drinking now is awful. And not drinking is awful. and I feel stuck. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I got sober in 1978, but by God's grace and the fellowship and steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and a lot of actions on my part, I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion altering substances since Halloween 1978. That is applause not for me. That's applause for Alcoholics Anonymous. I could, if I had a picture, I'd show you what my best efforts at fixing my life had done. That's really not me. And I got sober, and there was nothing to celebrate now that I'm sober. I mean, this sobriety was, it was awful for me. I mean, so what I do is I put on a smile, and I go to the meetings, and I try to look like you feel, and it's a losing battle for me. And I don't know what's wrong with me. But just because I quit drinking didn't mean that I stopped suffering from depression and bouts of anxiety. And it didn't mean that I stopped feeling those awful pains of anxious apartness that Bill talks about in the 12 by 12. That feeling like it's all of you in the meeting having a really good time, and then there's me. And I had a lot of that in early sobriety, and I didn't quit just because I went away, and I just go to meetings and pretend. It was almost like I had my sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous invisible suit that I would put on as I'm going into the meeting so I can look like I'm having a good time here. I'm the guy that work better, feel better, having a better time, you know, that talks about a vision for you. But secretly, inside myself, I'd have given anything to get back to the good old days when alcohol worked. And the only reason I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous is after 7.5 years of relapse, and I get a truth that is beyond me, that there's nothing I can do to jumpstart that and get that back. And I was a mope in my early sobriety. I suffered from untreated alcoholism for quite a while until I turned the corner in AA. And it didn't happen as a result of not drinking. I was like kind of guy, if you asked me how I was doing, I'd go, hanging in there. I was down at the TIE club I'm from Las Vegas, in Las Vegas a couple years ago, and I said the same thing to this guy. I said, how you doing? And he said the thing. I know exactly what he meant. He had this look on his face of like despair. And he says, well, I guess it's not bad if you don't weaken. I get that, man. I understand. Hang on there. You know, just hang in. Hang in, because your surrender, you'll be really rocketed into the fourth dimension when you finally surrender. And I could not get what you got by going to the meetings. I had to do a whole bunch of other stuff. And it's the steps, the service, and Alcoholics Anonymous. I got involved in service. I've been in service, and I've never not had a job in AA. At least one. Never. And tell you briefly what happened to me. I had two psychiatrists tell me one time I probably have taken medications all my life, and I haven't taken anything since I got here. But I was a mope in early sobriety. Let's tell you a little story. There's a guy in the back of the room who really helped me, saved my life, really. A guy named Dick. And Dick was having a party in a big house up on the hill with tennis courts, and he used to have a lot of AA parties. Having a party one time. Open house party, which means everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous is invited, right? Open house party. But I didn't get he didn't call me up personally. And really tell me how much I was needed there. And so I'm not going, right? Because my case is special, right? Nobody else gets a personal invitation, but I got to have a personal invitation. I'm not going. Guy calls me up. Morning is Sunday's party, Sunday afternoon, called me up Sunday morning. I was going to go to a meeting, and he says, going up to Dick's house. No, I'm not. I'm not going up there. He said, why not? He said, I don't think they want me up there. He says, no, they want you up there. They're expecting you up there. Everybody up there. Your whole home group's going to be up there. All your friends are going to be up there. No, I'm going to watch TV. Right? This is the guy. See, I'm more used to that than I am going to some place and trying to get out of myself and trying to have a good time. That is more familiar to me. There's a sick, warm, self-obsessed, narcissistic feeling of security in that. There's a whole bunch of people at that party, I don't know, and I don't know what they're thinking, and they're going to be looking at me, and I don't know what they want, and I'll just sit here and feel sorry for myself. Thank you. So this is, I'm not a celebrating sobriety kind of guy, you know, I'm just not. I used to sink in these deep depressions. I called up a friend of mine, AA, one time. I was really in a bad spot. I said, God, I just feel awful. He says, how long you felt like that? I've always felt like that. He said, no, you were laughing and carrying on the other night at the home group. Well, I was probably in denial. Well, you know, but it looks that way. When you're a mope, it looks like you've always been a mope and you'll always be a mope. It looks that way. It's like taking a drug, that depression stuff. It's a narcissistic self-involvement where it changes your whole perception. And when they say in the book, selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of our trouble, they're not kidding. And when that psychiatrist said to me, you're suffering from clinical depression, it looked like clinical depression. But it wasn't. It was the depression of the obsessively, overly self-involved. I just stop drinking and I get my life and my feelings right here like that creature and alien that attaches itself to your face. So, I'm a little over a year sober and I still have these bouts of this moody stuff and all this crap. I'm hanging in there. I'm in service. And the 12-step calls that I'm going on and the meetings I take going to the detox and all that stuff give me these little relief periods that I don't know. I don't understand, because when you're not in the middle of the relief and you're in the middle of the other, it looks like you've been in the other all the time, right? And I've gone to two meetings this one day, and I come home and I live in this little apartment. I'm not doing too well yet financially, just struggling, trying to make amends and do that stuff like we all do in early sobriety. And I started sinking into this deep depression. And I'm not talking about just being a little blue. This is a bad one, and it's coming on me. It's the kind of depression where you feel like you weigh 1,000 pounds. You can't get off the sofa. It's horrible. And I'm just pondering my life. And the more I look at it, and the more I ponder it, the bleaker it looks. Right? And I'm still a victim of a delusion that talks about in chapter 5. It says that the delusion that we can wrest happiness and satisfaction out of this world by managing well. In other words, I'm going to think myself out of this abyss. Mm-hmm. And if you've done that, you know it doesn't work. The more you think about it, the deeper you go, It's just, it's awful. So I'm sitting there, and I don't know what to do. I said a little prayer to the air, because I don't know, conscious contact with God. A little prayer to the air, and look at the clock, and it's about 10 to 10, and there's a meeting at 10:15, not too far from my house, a place called Duffy's. And it's called the Between the Shows group of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a lot of guys here from Vegas who have been to that meeting. And we used to call it the Star Wars bar meeting, because there was really strange people would show up there, street people, and then people in tuxedos from the hotels. You know, it was a really weird mix. So I somehow muscle myself off this sofa, And I walk out to my car like a mope. I mean, I'm really getting the gift, you know what I'm saying? And I walk out to the car like a mope, and I get in the car, and I drive down to the meeting. There's a space right in front of me, and I park there. I go into the meeting, and I'm sitting in the back of towards the back of the room on the side, and I can't hear nothing in the meeting. What's being shared in the meeting is like music in a doctor's office. The big show's on the inside, right? I am totally self-consumed, you know, pondering my life and how awful it is, and this job I have is going nowhere, and this, you know, I'm never going to have anything, and nobody's ever going to love me, and I'm never going to have a relationship, and I'm going to live in this crummy apartment for all my life, and I'll eventually be 60 years old one day eating cat food out of a can. And, you know, well, that's my mind. That's where it goes, you know. I just never sit alone and think, and it's good, right? It always goes that way, you know? I don't know why. I'm just that inclination. So I'm in the meeting, and I can't hear nothing. There's a guy sitting across from me who's coming off a drunk, and I mean, he is in bad shape. He's so sick that he's sitting there and he's grabbing himself like this and he's rocking back and forth like he's going to jump out of his skin. And then he can't sit still. And then he gets up and he's pacing back and forth behind me like a caged animal. And then he goes into the bathroom. I can hear him in there. He's dry heaving. And I'll tell you something. This guy's just annoying the crap out of me. I mean, I got some problems in my life here I'm trying to figure out. I mean, you know, really. So the meeting's over, and this guy, Charlie P., I stay after the meeting to help Charlie P. No. God, that sounds funny. No. I stay after the meeting to help the secretary, Charlie, whose last initial is P, to set the chairs up and everything. Anyway, and we're the last two to leave the meeting, Charlie and I. And Charlie has to go to work. He works up at, I think it was a Castaways, one of those old bust-out places up on casinos on the strip. He works at the graveyard shift, and he's got to go to work, and he's locking up, and we're standing on the front porch of the chapel, and over there is my car, and laying on the ground in front of my car is the guy coming off the drunk. Now, I'm going to have to step over him to go home and think, which I would be willing to do, except Charlie's there pointing at this guy, and he can't help him. He's got to go to work, and Charlie's got a big mouth. If I don't help this guy, Charlie's going to go all over Alcoholics Anonymous telling him what a bad member I am, and I'm looking at Charlie, and I'm looking at this guy, and oh, man. Oh. And I go over to him, and the guy's peed his pants, you know, and he's a mess, and he's afraid he's going to go into seizures, and he has no insurance, and he has no money, and there's no detox. And at that time in Vegas, they closed down Starting Point, and they hadn't opened this other place, West Care. There's a period of time where if you didn't have insurance and you needed to be detoxed, man, you were in a lot of trouble. Some members of AA's take guys in their home. They'd sit with them in shifts and give them a shot of vodka every hour. They used to do that, which I sat in on one or two of those. It was a grueling thing, and I couldn't do that. I was by myself. I had to get to work in the morning, and I don't know what to do, and there was only one thing to do, and you could take the guys like this down to this county hospital. But it was a bad deal because they didn't like taking these indigent patients, but they were forced to take them because they got some government money that made them accountable, and they were forced to take them. But they'd treat you like a redheaded stepchild. I'm telling you, they'd let you sit there 5-6 hours sometimes with these guys because they don't want to treat them because they know they're just next week they'll be back again. So I get this guy in my car, and we're driving over there, and he smells, and I'm thinking, isn't it enough that my life's crap? Doesn't anybody else ever step up to the plate in AA except me? I'm going to be tired tomorrow, have a bad attitude, probably lose that job. It's a lousy, lousy job anyway, you know. But I don't say any of that to this guy. Just driving. Get to the county hospital park. We're going. We're sitting in the waiting room. I'll tell you how long ago it was. You could smoke in hospital waiting rooms in those days. I'm giving the guy cigarettes, and he's vibrating, flying apart, and they're ignoring us like they're supposed to. And I'm going over to the vending machine. I'm getting cans of orange juice, because in the old days, they used to give guys orange juice and honey, but there wasn't any honey, so I take it over to the coffee bar, and I pour sugar in it, shake it up, and give it to the guy, and he'd drink that, and he'd spill it, and he's, you know, he's a mess. And he starts telling me about himself. And he starts telling me about how he's overcome with shame and guilt for the things he did to his family and some of the people that loved him. He tells me how he's been thinking about suicide, but he's such a coward, he doesn't have the courage to actually do it. And then he says something that really hooks me. He says, I don't know why you're wasting time with me. You see, I'm not like you people in AA. I always drink again. And he's telling me about me. I was a chronic relapser for 7.5 years, and I sat in these rooms, and I knew I wasn't like you. And he's telling me about me, and somewhere in the wee hours of the morning, I'll tell you, I fell in love with this guy. And I fell in love, and for no good reason. I mean, this idiot has nothing. He can't get me a better job. I mean, he has nothing. He's probably not even going to stay sober a year and give me some kind of credit for something. You know, there's nothing this guy can do for me except he suffers from alcoholism exactly like I'd suffered from alcoholism. And I fell in love with him, and years later I realized that what I was loving, I was loving the me that was in him, right? And they said, people used to say to me, we're counselors. You say, well, you've got to forgive and love yourself. I couldn't do it. But I started to do it with you, and a funny thing happened. And I'm driving. They finally checked him in, wee hours of the morning. I'm driving home. Sun's getting ready to come up. I got tears running down my face. I got tears running down my face because I, up until that moment, I don't know that I've ever felt more complete, more whole, more right about my life. I sat there in that car driving home, and I hadn't even prayed, and I felt God's presence in that car. I'm telling you, this is not an unconscious contact. He was there. And I didn't even say, come here. I didn't even try to talk to him. He just came into my life. And I felt like cheering. And I realized that's what I'm here for. That is my primary purpose. And in carrying out my primary purpose, do I get to treat the real secret sickness of alcoholism, this malady of my spirit that really gets worse when the bottle is behind me. And I haven't looked back. I've been trying to do that I try to do some of that every day of my life. I have guys I sponsor, several of them in this room. They call me, and they think I'm helping them. I don't know. I'll tell you something. If you're an alcoholic of my type, I don't know how you could stay sober for a prolonged period of time without service and helping other alcoholics. I don't know about you. I can't sit. I live a good life today. I just came from Rome, and for 10 days in Rome. Before that, I was in Maui for a week. I have a big house. I have a rich, abundant life. I can sit in the middle of my rich, abundant life, which is a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, not a result of my getting brighter when I got here. And I could sit in the middle of that life and get suicidal, left alone, helping nothing or no one except me. And get suicidal. That's why guys in million-dollar homes stick pistols to their head. With sober 20 years, they do it. Because I am compelled to serve something. And I'll either serve myself, or I'll serve an ethic and a set of principles greater than myself. But I'll tell you, I'm going to serve something one way or the other. I don't have a choice. And I know what it's like in sobriety to serve myself, and it's not good. And I know what it's in sobriety to serve you, and ultimately through serving you, that's really the only way I can serve God, really. I mean, God, I don't know about you, but God don't call me up and say, go here. I mean, some guy in AA calls me up and says, go here. And I say, oh, okay, I'll go there. And if I'm serious about the decision I made in step three, so there's only one answer I have in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's yes. There's only one answer. There's no, I don't feel like it. Or I don't like that type of service. Or I don't like... Right. Who's in charge when I'm saying that? I mean, you know, that's the same guy that wouldn't let me in here. That's the guy that wants me out of here. Right? The great I am. And so I'll tell you, I was thinking about what I was going to say and what I was afraid of. As I was afraid I was going to tell you about how I celebrate my life with it because it's so wonderful. And I was afraid that I'd get up here and get real self-aggrandizing. And I was afraid that it was going to all be about me. Because if I got up here and did that, there's nothing of any value in that, really. The real celebration of my sobriety is with the guys I sponsor, that I get to watch them do the impossible. I get to watch guys that could never get their kids back get their kids back. I get to watch guys buy their first house who were homeless. I get to watch guys help other guys, and I watch the light come on in their eyes as they're being useful, and they're getting the feeling I got in the car 25 years or so ago as I'm coming home from the hospital. And I'll tell you something, that is the celebration of sobriety. That is the celebration of our lives, passing it along. We all know a secret truth. We've known it because we've tried it and lived it. No matter how good we can make it get out here, if it ain't no good in here, it ain't no good. And I can't make it good in here by making it good out here. So what happens is I try to make it good for you, and a funny thing happens, it gets better for me in here. And I want to tell you, I got one more thing to say, and then I'll shut up. I love Alcoholics Anonymous.
That's awesome. You know, just the word is awesome. Both Gerald and Colley, Bruce, Bob, those are some awesome speakers, man. See, and that's what we get out of sobriety. Not drinking, not dry. Sobriety. Working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, being of service to each other, that you can relate to all the stories, and you can see a little bit of yourself in them. And I just love Alcoholics Anonymous also. And I guess we're going to have to close, and I'm kind of sad about that. You know, because, see, I'm one of the ones, see, I want to think about, oh, God, tomorrow we're going to have the closing ceremony. And then it's all over for another 5 years. And gee whiz, why can't it be longer? You know, that's me. You know, I can't enjoy the moment right now. The moment. You know, how awesome this was. I want tomorrow to be awesome. And next week, and it's okay because I'm doing okay with this. You know, one day at a time, I'm pretty well celebrating sobriety. Because ever since I got, and I have to say this, you know, the first place I ever celebrated sobriety, I was with a hangover after I slipped, and I was at a place that they call Dunfretton Farm. See, Dunfretton Farm. See, that's Texas. See, I wasn't born in Texas. See, you might figure that out. But and it's got this sign that says Dunfretton. And I had to be stupid enough to ask my sponsor, what the heck does Dunfretton mean? And I've been sober ever since. So that's yeah. Not as long as some, but okay for me. It fits me. It fits my program. It's a little over 17 years, and it's okay with me. look, I'd like to take this time and let you join me. We'll close this with the Serenity Prayer, please.
I'm going to go down there, huh? I'm going to go right here.